Blog Talk Radio.
What's up, world, and welcome to Realty Universal Radio, the fastest hour in radio, no doubt about it. I'm Randy Zachary, and this is a show about real estate, about God, about life, about giving back, about being the change in the world that you'd like to see. I'm privileged to bring to you Natalie Mullinex and Realty Universal, a company dedicated to excellence. Realty Universal is a revolution founded on a very simple principle. We believe sellers and buyers should have choices. We have been a pioneer in the menu program system. More on that, of course, a little later. Natalie Mullinex, president and founder of Realty Universal, averaged over $80 million a year in sales prior to stepping back to focus more on building Realty Universal membership network. She's an accomplished speaker, writer, consultant, trainer, and, oh, by the way, mother. She travels worldwide, literally, spreading the gospel, if you will, of Realty Universal. And now, Natalie Mullinex.
Hey, everybody. I'm so happy to be here this week and be here another week and share this hour with you. And I hope wherever you are, you're enjoying your time and coming on the other side of COVID and everything. We have so much going on. So many changes have happened in the last year and a half and still changing. I am so excited today because we are, you know, you look at life and you think, what can I do? Can I do this? Can I do that? How much can I serve and give back? And many times, you know, we look back and say, I wish I could have, should have done this. And there's really no time for that. We have to have faith in where we are and we're doing what we say. But it's easier said than done. And I look at what I've been doing with Realty Universal, and I feel like I haven't done anything when I look at what Maxine Clark has done. And we're going to talk today to Maxine Clark, and I'm so thrilled that she has the time to come on and talk to us. And I think a lot of us do that in life. There's always time. There's always time to do what we want to do and serve and give back. And so this whole hour, we are not going to talk about real estate, except, of course, some locations. But Maxine Clark is the founder of Build-A-Bear Workshop, a teddy bear-themed retail entertainment experience. In 1996, Maxine left her long and successful career in retail with the May department stores and her role as then president of Payless Shoe Source to start her own business focused on engaging children through the idea of what was not yet specific. After an unsuccessful trip to a local toy store with her 10-year-old best friend's daughter, Katie, to buy a Beanie Baby, the ideal for Build-A-Bear was born. Katie said, "We could make these." And 9 months later, the first store opened in St. Louis, Missouri. A generation of makers began. Today, there are over 400 Build-A-Bear workshop stores worldwide. Nearly 200 million stuffed animals have been sold worldwide. And I'm sure many of you listening know what Build-A-Bear Workshop is, especially if you have children and grandchildren. Well, Maxine stepped down from her chief executive bear position in 2013 to start her next act, to help unleash the potential of women and minority entrepreneurs and to use her entrepreneurial skills to create platforms and places that give access to more St. Louis families. This is so exciting. Her latest venture is the Del Mar Divine, the transformation of a neighborhood eyesore, which was the historic St. Luke's Hospital, into what is becoming now a multi-use real estate development to open in late 2021. So we are talking a very little bit about real estate, but big thing, because this is where we live, and our home is our homes and businesses and all of it is just so amazing to see what transformation Maxine is doing with her visions and the practicality and actually making it happen. This just gives me the chills, and I'm so excited. Maxine is a founding manager director of Prosper Women's Capital, a St. Louis-based accelerator for women-led businesses, the board of advisors of Lewis and Clark Ventures, and an advisor to the TXO Fund. Maxine is a member of the Build-A-Bear Workshop, Foot Locker, Inc., and Big Dot of Happiness Board of Directors. Also a member of the Washington University Board of Trustees and the New America Parents as Teachers and PBS National Boards. In 2017, Maxine was named to the Missouri Public Affairs Hall of Fame, and in 2015 was named Woman of the Year by Greater Missouri Leadership Foundation. Maxine's a graduate of University of Georgia and holds an honorary Doctor of Laws degree from St. Louis University and an honorary Doctor in Human Letters from the University of Missouri, St. Louis, and an honorary Associate's degree from St. Louis Community College. In 2006, she published her first book, The Bear, B-E-A-R, I love that, Necessities of Business, Building a Company with Heart. And without further ado, I'd like to introduce Maxine Clark. Hi.
Hi there. How are you today?
I'm wonderful. I'm just so thrilled. I know how your schedule is just like you got so much in there. I'm so thrilled that you're on with us today. And
I'm glad to be here.
It's just you've done so much, and it's like you know they always talk about you getting things done, and then actually we dream about it, we visualize, but you've actually put it into play. I don't know how you've done this much, and I'm just so honored to see. I guess you can we'll hear about that today too. So tell us what started when you were younger. What sparked this drive that you have to serve and to give back, and you accomplish it all.
So I guess my family, you know, it always goes back to the way you're raised and what you see around you. But my parents were first-generation Americans, did not go to college. My father learned his trade. He was an electrician in the military. And my mother learned her trade, which I would say would be social welfare, working for Eleanor Roosevelt when she was the first lady. Her private traveling secretary, so she traveled around to different places with her. And because Eleanor Roosevelt was out for the good of humankind, and as the first lady in those days, you went to everything that was a social welfare. That's what she was sort of in charge of. And she went and saw, you know, like mental institutions and hospitals where people were, you know, put for life, you know, where they were, that was the only way they could live was if they were institutionalized. And she didn't believe that was necessary. And she implored all these women that worked for her after the war and after Roosevelt died and she left office and he left office, she went to go do something about this. And so my mother and four of her friends started a school for children with Down syndrome in Miami, Florida. And Down syndrome, it wasn't called that then. It was called mongoloidism. They didn't really even know what it was. You know, they didn't spend any time. They just put children in institutions because they couldn't be cured of it. And they left them there to basically, you know, vegetate and to eventually die. And my mother was, you know, a pioneer, as were many, many other women across the country, founding these schools and making it possible for children with disabilities, or my mother would have called them different abilities, to grow and prosper.
She wouldn't call it.
Contributing citizens of our community. So I learned that there. I won't tell you that I thought that, I always thought my mother was a good doobie, but I didn't think that I would be doing all that kind of work. I wanted to be a capitalist. And
did you?
I grew up in the 60s, so I wanted to be anything that a woman didn't do. And when I graduated from college, I didn't want to be a teacher, a nurse, a social worker, or a secretary. I wanted to be a lawyer. And I went off to law school, but I had to pay for it. And I went to work in a job. I got a job as an executive trainee at the Heck Company in Washington in retail. And the Make Company, which owned the Heck Company, was a very charitable company. And early on, they told us about a matching gifts program. So if you gave $10, they would match it with another $10. And that's all I could give in the beginning, you know, to different programs. Of course, we had the United Way signing up to give your fair share. And I couldn't wait till I made enough money that my fair share was substantial. So I always thought about it as that was a way of being, you know, it was a good example set for me by my family and then by my employer. And ultimately, the May Company had this matching gifts program, and it was a limit. And I remember I got a note from them when I hit the limit. I was so honored that I finally hit the limit because it was like $5,000. So that meant I gave $5,000 and they turned it into $10,000. You know, so that was a lot. And that was the way, you know, you just learn by example. And when you see successful people that you admire being charitable, you also see that's a part of being a successful person, giving back to your community.
Absolutely. That's absolutely. Well, so your mom, back then, even with the different, you said Down syndrome and different things, there were so many people that were put in institutions, women and men, with what they would call mental illnesses that weren't, right? Things that could be solved and changed, and oh gosh, that was just took a lot of
it was just the way it was. And, you know, it took a lot of women. That was the thing that I think is really important to note, is that women did a lot of this changing about society. It was women that did the Moms Against Drunk Driving, and women that did about, mm-hmm. you know, fighting for seatbelts, and women that fought against, you know, fought for these different abilities. And because women were not working then, they were the ones in charge of raising the money and creating the events and door-to-door campaigns. My mother was also very active in League of Women Voters, because women had, it wasn't that, well, it was quite a few years, but it wasn't always that women had the right to vote. And my mother was a big believer in democracy and us showing our, being loyal. And I voted from the minute I could vote, you know, like I knew I was supposed to do that, and
right.
I did. And so, you know, I was always proud and excited to do it. And so I think that those are things that, you know, we should be passing on to our children and setting examples for our employees that work with us and other people that we know, especially young people, setting an example that that does matter, that it does, it is part of what gets you where you're going, is the kinds of things that you do above and beyond the call of duty.
Serving and giving back and changing, exactly. It's just...
And I encourage as many young people as I can to join the Service Corps, Peace Corps, Teach for America, City Year, AmeriCorps. There's so many ways you can serve your country, and it's only asking you to do it for a few years, but it gives you a huge connection to the challenges that exist in our society and maybe gives you the will to even do more.
That's just amazing. I remember when Eleanor Roosevelt, she got a lot of pushback in her time. She was really such
mm-hmm.
a strong woman to keep, no matter what, she ignored a lot of the pushback, and I think that was just so amazing. I remember a comment that I heard that she said once, because she got so much pushback, was like, all the water in the world can't hurt you unless you let it in your lungs, you know, unless you breathe it. And just
mm-hmm.
forge,
mm-hmm.
what a pioneer for all of us. It's
I think she.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
No. Go ahead.
No. I was.
That's all I was.
I was just going to say she was. You know, she was a woman before her time, and she used her position, the wife of Franklin, a woman from a wealthy family, to draw attention to the needs of the country, and that was what she probably would have done anyway, because there were so many needs. But I think that was the role that women were. Put to, you know, like you're the social services, women always care about that. And I think that
mm-hmm.
she was just saying, yes, I care about it, but I'm going to make a real difference.
Mm-hmm. Didn't let it stop, anything stop her, which is, it sounds like your mom was the same way, and you are too, you know, to get it through. And it's just that we have so many issues in society and that's going on. So tell us, you're a true innovator in the retail industry. I mean, you saw a need, and you went out and did it, but you made it fun. You made it with the Build-A-Bear. It looks like you saw the need and had been in this industry. And what was, you blended the families and customers to get them involved. Tell us, what were you thinking back then, because you were so far ahead of your time, and it's
yeah.
proven to work. And now you're doing the same thing with the St. Luke's Hospital.
Yeah, I think that, you know, when you think about, you know, you never should be too far away from your roots. And when you think about what, you know, we enjoyed as children, you know, and you think about what gave you your creative spark, what were the things that you really enjoyed? And one of the things that I really enjoyed was field trips, you know, going on a field trip to a bakery or to a dairy farm or whatever we did as children. And it wasn't anything fancy. It was the things that were close to home that you could take a bus to and, you know, go there and
mm-hmm.
be back in the same day. But they were, you know, wow, that's cool. And I think that I've always felt that we always are thinking now, especially in the world of technology, about how do we use technology to inspire kids. Well, I still think it's back to the good old basics. We forget those. We throw them away.
Right.
I was recently, not recently, but right before COVID, we forget time right now, but right before COVID,
mm-hmm.
I went to visit a local early childhood center here in town, and the children live near a busy commercial district, and the school had walked the children up to the commercial district, the little 2, 3, 4, and 5-year-olds, a preschool, and they took pictures with the teachers' iPads and phones, and they came back and they recreated this street called Del Mar. In their school, made it out of cardboard, used pom-poms to make the red, yellow, and green stoplight. So in this process of making this three-dimensional bunch of boxes really out of cardboard, they learned directions. They learned about north, south, east, and west. They learned about stop signs. They learned about crosswalks. They learned about the names of shops. And one of the reasons they took them there was because it's close by, and they might wander away from the school and feel lost, but they didn't want them to be lost. They wanted them to know where they were and also to learn how to spell by things and that were around them.
That's brilliant.
And what was coffee and how do you spell coffee? And it was really brilliant. I ended up calling recently. I called the principal, and I said, do you still have that? And she said, yes, it's right here in the hallway. And I said, could I buy it from you? You know, I'd like to make a donation, and I'd like to put it in a glass, enclose it in glass, and put it in our building, which is down Del Mar, but far east from where they are. And because I want people to know that children can still do this. At 2, 3, 4, and 5 years old, they can make something that looks this fantastic. I would send you a picture after this so you can see it.
I love it.
It was amazing.
I love it.
And the kids were, some of the kids were, it was on October, and it was, they were getting ready to walk outside and go on a, they were going for a walk, and I said, where are you going? And they said, we're going to collect specimens. And I was thinking, okay, what kind of specimens? And they were looking for leaves because it was October.
Oh,
they had to find 10 different color leaves, and they were going to come back to their classroom. This little girl told me this. And they're going to look at them under the microscope, and then they're going to match them to the tree that they belong, the kind of tree that they were growing
from.
And then we'll know what kind of trees are in the schoolyard. This is all in the backyard of the school. And we can trade with other kids if we get one color and they don't have that. And then our teacher is going to help us make a wreath out of the leaves. And I thought to myself, this is simple, basic stuff. You know, this isn't
and they're
fancy
learning
arts
so
and
much.
Craft supplies. Yeah, and,
right.
they're little teeny ones. They were learning, they were using, somebody had donated Scrabble boards to them. So they were setting up, there's no desks, just nice cushy chairs. They had some tables for art and for working on their words. And so they were putting together words on using the little Scrabble holder. So she asked me my name. One of the little girls asked me my name, and I said, it's Maxine. And so she spelled it M-A-C-E-E-N, which is pretty close for a three-year-old. You know,
right.
Like it's
oh,
M-A-X-I-N-E.
Yes.
And I thought, well, should I correct her? And the teacher gave me the look, like, yeah, go ahead and correct her. And she's, oh, Maxine. I thought you said Maxine. You know, so it was very interesting how they're learning to spell. And I think that those are the things that I remember and I know that are basic to childhood. And I thought that we could create in a local mall something fun that kids would want to go to. Their parents would come to the mall more often, too, which is exactly what did happen. And I think that I went in the store and when Katie said to me, you know, they didn't have the Beanie Baby that she wanted. And they said, she said, these are easy. We could make these. Well, she meant go home and start a craft business, but I thought we could make a factory.
You saw the whole big picture.
Making our own stuffed animals.
Wow.
I thought I had a Willy Wonka moment in my head. And when she went downstairs to get out the stuff, she came up to find me, and I was on the computer looking for a business to see if I could find a business in America that I could buy and turn into this retail idea that I had. And she said, well, I didn't mean that. And I said, I know you didn't, but you gave me this really good idea.
Oh,
so,
I love it.
You know, 9 months later, you know, because we have these great malls located all across the country, I went to the mall owner. I said, I'd like to open up this store. I had kind of pencil sketches of what I wanted to do. And he said, you know, okay, come back with a more formal plan and we'll talk about it. And I got the woman that helped me do branding, you know, many times over on different projects in Chicago. She helped me put this together and we came up with a name and I went to him and they leased me the space and I went and got a, she helped me find somebody to make the fixtures. And 9 months later we had a store and we were selling product. I knew how to do all this. I just never thought of it, putting it into the place where kids could come and make their own stuffed animals. And it was the perfect timing because it was also the beginning. It was 1997 when we first opened, and there were all this technology. So everything was around kids was about hard screens, and this was something soft. And so I think it was just its perfect timing, and parents all had stuffed animals. You might have only had one teddy bear or one bunny rabbit. Now kids have multiple. But you knew what that was, and it was something to do with your children in your neighborhood. And so it became very, you know, very, very popular very fast, and nobody else had done that. In fact, about the following year, in 1998, Joe Pine and his partner came out with a book called The Experience Economy. And we were really the beginning of the experience economy. But they were talking about how we went from, you know, growing flour on the farm and then making a birthday cake from scratch to buying boxed birthday cakes to now going to the grocery store and ordering a birthday cake, and it's the most elaborate birthday cake, to now having birthday parties in stores, which, of course, we already have.
Right.
And so, you know, I think
right.
these are the kinds of things that have evolved, but you've got to be in step with the trends. And I think I've always been in step with the trends because I am the customer. I'm not, although I'm, you know, an affluent customer, and now I'm an older customer, I still have my hands on what young people are wanting and doing. And, of course, at the time when I was that customer, I was successful because I knew what the young working woman customer wanted, and I was bringing that to the marketplace. And then at Payless, we put in Payless Kids because parents wanted an affordable place to buy kids' shoes. And they wanted
– Oh,
yeah,
is that what the Payless Kids?
Well, we had Payless, and we had Payless Kids. And usually it was just racks in the store. It was just, you know, another size in the big Payless store. But we created these stores right next door to our store that was a Payless Kids store, which really made it many more choices for kids than what we had in just a size run. And parents loved it because they could come in, they could sit down with their kids. It was an easy option, and they weren't $50. So it worked out to be, you know, another, you know, experience, you know, children – having, and we helped them. You know, we found their shoe size. We got it down for them. We had made the store fun, and that was another experience. I mean, everything doesn't have to be black and white. It can have some red, yellow, blue, green, color, purple, you know, making it much more fun and exciting for the customer. And most stores, you know, in the mall do a pretty good job. I think everybody's sort of fallen off track, not because of COVID, but COVID uncovered a lot of ails in the retail business. And I think now people are starting to think about the experience of re-putting the experience back into retail. It's always
in,
about
in the shopping
about
centers, you think? Right.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think the good centers are figuring that out, and the good retailers are figuring it out. Not only do they figure out how to have their customers still order from them online, and they would either deliver it to their curbside or, you know, ship it to them from the store. Retail, successful retailers have done really well the last 6 or 8 months because they've got the hang of what COVID required them to do. Many of them should have been doing it beforehand, but they weren't.
Definitely. But do you think with the online, with, you know, the Internet's been so prevalent now for the last 20 years, you know, for public, do you think that with online the brick and mortar is going to go away or no, if they're smart enough to get in or innovative enough to it won't go away?
It'll never go away, but I think there'll be less centers that people really want to go to, and that center has to be, you know, a multi-use center, you know, with food and entertainment and retail stores that people want to go to, not the same old, same old. The other thing that's interesting is, you know, when malls first came about in the 50s and 60s, they were, you know, unique. You couldn't, you know, they weren't national retailers at that time. Those were local retail stores that were the only place you could go to them. I grew up around Dadeland Mall in Miami, which, you know, is a gigantic mall now, but it was a small mall, outdoor mall, and the best stores were at Dadeland. So we went there for special occasions. You went shopping in a mall like that for special occasions, and the and malls got to be so commercial that you could find, they all became Gap and national chains, and it, no mall was any different than any other mall, really, except the most exclusive malls, which not everybody wanted to go to, that had the fanciest stores. And still there's some of those around Miami, and some tourist destinations or some unique stores that still have local retail. But for the most part, they became just a copy of each other. And you have 10 of those in a city. Even in St. Louis, we have you know, all the malls looked alike. They had the same stores. And you wonder, why are they opening another Brooks Brothers 5 miles away, or another store like this 5 miles away? What do they know that I don't know? You don't really need that. And malls just were hungry for tenants, so they took everybody. And some malls still were particular. They didn't want as many teen stores. They wanted more upscale stores. But again, there weren't enough of those. Some of those people were not staying in business or not getting into the online, not staying service-minded. And it got to be a hodgepodge of just different things. And I think that now there's so much empty space in the mall, they can repurpose them. Maybe it should also be a local fantastic gym in the mall. Maybe there should be.
That's a good idea. And then
COVID,
the food, and again, and maybe and services.
I thought in COVID, I thought during COVID they should have had a testing site or a vaccination
site.
That
makes sense.
Put it up in a store that's empty and make it so that everybody feels safe, and not politicize it, but make it like, when you come to the mall, we're going to make sure you're healthy and take care of you. They had, you know, the stations, the sanitizing stations and signs that said masks, but, you know, that wasn't really, you know, particularly different than anybody else.
Right.
Yeah, they could have done it differently. And I think that they just didn't jump on it. And then some people told me, well, Maxine, if we do that, people will feel, you know, sad when they come to the mall. They'll see a place to get a shot. I said, I don't think so, but, you know, you go with whatever way you want. I was throwing it out to some of the mall developers.
You know, because you've been in it for so long.
Didn't
you know. But I know with schools, for example, like when you grew up, we didn't have to worry about shootings in schools, and I don't want to sound negative, you know, but nowadays you hear about different situations. And I mentioned to somebody that in this career, I said, why aren't they putting, I mean, it's sad to say, but why aren't they putting in metal detectors in different schools to just to make people feel protected? And they said that psychologically, I was told, I don't know how much weight there is to this, but psychologically that it's going to scare the children more because they need to come to school and feel safe in their environment. So I don't know. I don't know what the research is going to end up showing on that, but there's a lot of particulars in our world right now that have changed so much for the younger generation, you know, because safety is such a big issue now that we didn't really deal with before. I mean, in the same...
Well, yeah, I think that some of those things can be built into the walls and hidden, and you wouldn't even know they were there.
That's a great idea.
But I do know that in urban school districts all around the country, here in St. Louis and the city schools, they've had to go through metal detectors. They find knives. They might find something that's metal, but they don't find guns usually. Kids don't bring those to school. That's not where they happen. I mean, none of those problems happen in black schools. Those all happened in schools that were predominantly white children. So sometimes we put the safety devices in the wrong places because we think our biases tell us, you must put it in a black school because that's where the danger is.
Right.
But in fact, every single one of those mass shootings didn't happen in a black school. They happened in either a diverse school or almost totally white school. And in case of Sandy Hook, and particularly in Florida, they were in affluent neighborhoods.
That is really interesting. And then I love what you're saying. You could do it, design it, put it behind the walls, do things that aren't going to be, hey, you've got to walk through this metal detector. You know, there's ways to do this, right?
Like when you go to the airport and you walk through a metal detector.
Constantly.
That could be built into. I'm sure that could be built into the into a wall that you would, you know, a doorway. You wouldn't know you were really walking through it. It might go off if you had something like it does now, and you probably could set it to go off for particular things, not just a nail file or something like that.
Right.
But I don't think we think about it, but I think there's ways to do it. Now that they're putting in air purifiers and other kinds of systems in schools,
they're
putting in automatic, paper towels so that you don't have to.
But that's brilliant. So why they're budgeting for all that, they could actually budget for the safety in that other way. That's great. Because figure out who could.
Well, they don't usually ask people that might have ideas. They just think they know. Educators talk to educators, and retailers talk to retailers, and airport.
And we needed to be out of the box.
People. What if they all talk to each other, you know, and said? And that's really what I think my strength is. I go to different places all over the world, or wherever I've gone. I love shopping in malls. It gives me creative ideas. You know, I see things in the hotel industry or in the grocery business or in the hospitality business that apply to retail every single day or it's my nonprofit work that I'm doing. And I don't think we cross over enough. People stay in their lanes. They're afraid to cross over to somebody else's lane because somebody might ask them a question they don't have an answer to or might really like their
idea. And that's okay, but
say,
I agree with you.
Why don't you come help me do it? Yeah. Everything's too siloed.
I agree. Real estate, I always used to say, why is it real estate when I wanted to be self-help and more other, you know, serving? And then I got the message years back because, you know, it was a vehicle, you know, although we're good because there's just so many other issues for us to work on. And sometimes we're put in places that, you know, we do can work through so much. I agree with you 100%. That's where people need to not be so concerned about voicing their opinion, you know, and putting the idea out there. Because with brick and mortar, it seems with the internet, so much of it's going away. But then when you look at the malls that need anchor stores and who's paying what, you know, who the anchor store brings in business and then, you know, and the percentages people have to pay, can the businesses afford it? Not anymore?
No, I don't think so. I think that, you know, it depends on what the anchor store is. But I bet you if you added up all of the Foot Locker brands in a mall, and what they add up to volume, they probably do as much as that Macy's does in that mall. I mean, it just doesn't look like that because it's not in one place. But, you know, Limited used to do more business in all the brands that they owned than a Macy's would do. They're substantial. And so the question is, what's the right mix in a mall? And who are the new and retailers? Are there, you know, the challenge is the customer's gotten so used to shopping online that they don't just go to the mall. They shop everywhere. I mean, I can buy. I was sitting on my phone the other night, just going through Instagram, and I must have bought seven things online. You know, I've never seen them or touched them. And I'm going to buy that. It's like I decide how much I can waste if it comes in or if I can send it back. And, you know, it's just amazing what you can do online. I had I left my iPad on the airport in the airplane a couple weeks ago going to a meeting in Minneapolis. And, of course, on my phone I have the Find Me app. So I knew I lost it, and I went back right away. They wouldn't let me through the security line. You know, it buzzed me on my phone that I left my iPad. And I went back to get it, and they wouldn't let me through. And they said, you'll have to file a – which is ridiculous.
Oh, no,
you have to file
ridiculous.
A report. And I filed a report, and I saw it. I watched it on my phone go all the way from Minneapolis. It was in Minneapolis for a week. Then it went down to this place that Delta uses in Scottsboro, Arkansas.
You can see that from the
iPad. It passed through St. Louis. It literally passed through St. Louis. And I saw it go on the highway, and it passed through, and it went down to Scottsboro. And then they let you know that they found it and that will you pay the money for to be shipped. And I finally have it back. But that was all technology. In the old days, you wouldn't have and I wrote them 16 times. I said, you know, I can see where my phone is. I know you found it, but you're not telling me. I'd get notes that say we have not located it yet, but I've located it. You know,
exactly.
So again, you know, why aren't we using some of this technology? And I wrote the CEO of Delta on LinkedIn. That was the only way I knew how to reach him, and told him that I had three ideas of how now that this has happened to me, I saw three ways they could do this much easily and probably save tons of time and gain customer service, a better relationship with their customer. Now I haven't heard from him yet, but just having that personal experience,
that is brilliant.
Most people just
right.
Yeah, most people just have an experience and say, I'm done with this. You know, screw this. I'm just not doing it anymore. But I don't. And I don't think most people in the retail business do either.
That's amazing. And I've always – one thing that's changed a lot is I've always been on the go for it, you know, keep going and going to it. But in the old days, we could call the CEO's office, you know, and or you know, one of these – somebody would help. But nowadays with many companies, you're just going to go back to customer service and no one's going to help you, which is wrong. I think that's one place that's really changing and missing. I know years ago I had my son's guitar. I was in first class, went to Hawaii, and I fell asleep because I had to change planes, and I fell asleep and left the guitar on the plane. This was early 2000s, and I left the guitar on the plane, and I went down and filed a report, and everybody said couldn't find it, and I was able to get, I don't even remember which airlines because I fly so much, but I got in touch with the CEO's office, and we had it in 2 days, right? But that was years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when there's an issue, many times with, you know, the larger companies, you're not going to get anywhere, though. You're not, nobody's going to return. You know, it's just, we're in a different world, and I hope that changes, you know, as far as the, because with technology and with, you know, the customer service can still be there, and it's much quicker, actually, if it's handled properly.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with you. The AI is really coming in. I think the artificial intelligence is going to help a lot with that. You know,
if you remember, I don't know where you grew up, but I grew up in Miami, and we had several locations that were sort of like downtown, if you will, or local shopping centers, but they were streets, you know, with lots of stores on them. And all those stores were one proprietor owned them. And eventually those stores got bought up by, you know, the Limited or somebody, you know, they became chain stores. Edison Brothers bought up chains, but everybody started with one. And Build-A-Bear started with one, and, you know, I'm sure the J. Crew started with one, and they might start with a catalog where they start. And we have to encourage entrepreneurship. We have to encourage in the retail business people to start up a store, make it easy for them easier for them. And many landlords do that, by the way. You know, I had no problem getting locations for Build-A-Bear. They were very supportive. In fact, the tenant allowance that we raised to open up Build-A-Bear stores probably speeded up our company growth by 10 times. They were so helpful. And that's the way land developers, mall owners were. They wanted the best, they wanted the first, they wanted the exclusive. And we were planning not to have a store in every mall. We didn't want that. We wanted to have 300 to 400 stores across America, which is not much when you think there's thousands and thousands of malls. So we were we were in demand, and they helped us grow our business. And I think that we have to get back to that and remember those basic tenets, that looking for that good idea that's out there, that it may not, it's in your mall, you let it start, it did really well. What's the second store? Not the next 10. You know, that some people can't handle that growth that fast. Or what kind of tools can you provide to them or other mentors to help them grow? Like, I'm a tenant in your mall, and I've been successful. Maybe I can help that tenant. you know, get bigger, tell them some of the pitfalls to look for, some of the things. I mean, we have to, if we want America to grow like what it's capable of doing, we have to be willing to share what we know and our experiences and our learned lessons with others. And I think that's the fun part of what I get to do today is I, you know, not, in addition to doing this project on Del Mar, which is a real estate development, it's all about location. It's almost always about location. The location now happens to be on the internet. And then how much are you going to get in front of that customer, the right customer on Instagram or Facebook or whatever it is. So it's still about location. But I think the issue is one of how do you inspire other entrepreneurs to get that business going, whether they start on the internet or they start with a store, and then go to pop-up stores if they started on the internet. And maybe that pop-up store never is not going to be 1,000 stores. It's going to be, you know, 50 stores, but it's going to be in 50 of the best malls in America. And they can do a lot of business 50 stores. Or you're going to get to be a pop-up store inside of an Ulta or a Target. It's still retail. It's still exciting for the customer. And I think we need to applaud all of those opportunities and encourage all of those opportunities.
I totally agree. I've been an entrepreneur since I was a teenager, but I started with a Realty Universal membership idea in 94, and I took it to other areas, but I didn't know like what Zillow does and Redfin, and we were pioneers, and it took a lot of arrows in the back when I took it, was the first to take it to Hawaii, but it was all about service and giving people choices. It's just, you know, it's different altogether, but and I'm working on different ways to get that out there through a membership association, because then it goes through a lot of small mom-and-pop brokers and agents and about serving. But I have a huge passion on it's time to heal, you know, because there's a lot of wounded families out there, and it starts in childhood and goes on to adulthood. And I'm wondering, because we look at, like how you get, well, how you get people involved with getting involved with activities, do something fun, bring the families in. Could you ever see, like, you know, how we have social services and possibly other learning tools? Some are implemented, others aren't, and tools to even engage the parents and the kids with a lot of domestic issues that are very prevalent, especially they've always been prevalent, but they're worse today. Huh?
No, they're worse today because there are, it's so expensive for a family to pay for early childhood, to pay for even a nanny, you know, like let's say you're going to have somebody even in your house. But think about the mall. Think about how much space a mall has.
Could we do it there, though?
Could it
be done in a mall? Could you think of, I mean, think about, couldn't it be?
Absolutely, it could.
I mean, for fun, but then also for the rest of it, like to get people engaged in some of the programs and different, that could, you know, instead
know.
Of it
I,
just
I,
being
I,
shopping.
There's an empty restaurant in the shopping center. They could give that space away to an early childhood center where parents can just drive up and drop their kids off. High quality. I'm not talking about a babysitting service. I'm talking about an early childhood educational center. And the mother and the father might, when they come back, they're going to go shopping in the mall. They're going to go eat in a restaurant. They're going to go have California pizza. Or they're going to go to a movie. Or they're going to do something else. I mean, we have to bring people, make it a community need. And the community needs that. It's unfortunately that mall rent would be too expensive if you're going to charge rent. But if you're thinking about it as a convenience for your customers, and you don't have to operate it, somebody else is going to operate it. So even all of your employees and the mall employees could send their child to that early child center.
There's a lot of grants. There's a lot of grants for the early childhood, for Head Start, for other programs that are actually in each individual state, and I'm wondering if those grants could be used for something like that. Because me, it's interesting what you're saying, because I always thought malls might be too expensive, but maybe they're not. You know, not if it's
a give back.
Well,
they are too expensive, but if they didn't look at it like that, if they have an empty space and they've had it for a really long time, and they thought about it because it's got an outside entrance, they thought about making it, giving it for a low rent, some rent, but low rent, $5 a foot, to an early childhood center who can now go out and get grants to pay teachers, to have, and they could have 100 or 200 kids in there. All the employees in the mall that have children, little children, could actually bring their children on their way to work.
That would be fantastic.
So you'd never have any absences.
They'd never
want to quit their job. They would want to work there. And then all the local people that live around there, they said, this is a really high-quality Montessori early childhood center. I want to send my child here. And so there are operators like that. The problem is that there's not enough – the one challenge is there's not enough teachers for early childhood paying. It should be the highest paying, but it's the lowest paying of all education-related jobs. And yet it's the biggest problem we have in our country.
But
we aren't doing right by our children.
No, and even coaching, there's things to do with parents and coaching and things that you and I would think are automatic that somebody isn't going to think is automatic. You know, that could be instituted. Well, tell us, with Delmar Divine, how did you decide to do that and take it on? And it's amazing because it sounds like you're doing exactly. You took the hospital, historic hospital. It's about 450,000 square feet, and you're turning it into a variety of nonprofits, housing. I mean, it's amazing what you're doing, but you're doing that. You're giving back to the community and instilling these, helping blend people together and fighting these issues. So it sounds like what you're doing could almost be a duplicate of what you're doing could be on a smaller scale in some of these other areas, in the malls.
It definitely is. I was working, one of my passions is education, because I went to public school my entire life and had a great education. And we had opened up a KIPP charter school, elementary school, in a neighborhood. This neighborhood should have been Hollywood and Vine in St. Louis. At one time it was.
Wow.
It's between Washington University undergrad and medical school campuses, one of the best colleges in the country, right near our version of Central Park. Right between two entertainment districts, the Loop, which is near WashU for undergrads, and then the Central West End, which is an adult, you know, lots of great restaurants and hotels and all that. So it was really, in any other city, this would have been zillions of dollars. And in the middle of this is a street, this intersection is called, that intersects north and south in St. Louis, black and white, rich and poor, is called Delmar. And on Delmar was, at one point in time, in the turn of the 19th to the 20th century, when the St. Louis hosted the World's Fair, it was the up-and-coming neighborhood, and this hospital was built in 1904. And it
Wow.
was open for, you know, decades. But in the 60s, pretty much started in the late 50s, early 60s, when Brown versus Board of Education and
different civil rights
laws were changing, when the schools became integrated, white people left. Shame on them, but they left
right.
because they were afraid that the children would go to school. These schools wouldn't be as good. They moved out to bigger neighborhoods. Also, happening at the same time, I'm not sure which came first, it was mall development. So lots of retail stores now had this air-conditioned location to operate in. And in places
wow.
like north of, you know, Missouri, that was a godsend because you didn't have to worry about rain or sleet or snow. People could shop in all kinds of temperatures. And so these malls popped up all over the country at just about the same time. I think the first one was in Edina, Southdale Mall in Minneapolis area. But then people copied it like they copy everything. And soon all
mm-hmm.
these local stores were in the malls, in the beginning of malls. And so there was nobody on those commerce streets, those main streets, and they became ghost towns almost all across America, but mostly in urban centers. And so the rural downtowns left much later. They were more impacted by the growth of Walmart and Walmart opening up super centers and Target than
oh,
they
right.
were by luxury shopping centers. But it happened more in the 70s and 80s than in the 50s and 60s. And so they were left abandoned. And houses, you know, that were once, you know, I call them Meet Me in St. Louis houses because of the movie Meet
Aww.
Me in St. Louis. They're
right.
huge. They're beautiful. They're mansions, actually. But they were left, many of them left to, you know, abandoned and or just left to be run down because people that own them couldn't even get second mortgages to improve their homes or home improvement loans because the value of the property was less than what they paid for the house. That's how
mm-hmm.
bad things got, especially in minority, majority
right.
neighborhoods. So this hospital was there from 1904 to 1980. In 1980, they sold it and moved to the county, and it became another hospital and another hospital and another hospital, and eventually it didn't have enough patients because there's nobody really living over there. And so they closed it, and I was driving by it when they put the for sale sign, and I said, what are they going to do with this? We just opened a school that's full with kids and with bright-eyed and bushy-tailed ready to learn, and this is going to really negatively impact the neighborhood. And, you know, I found out what the building would cost, and I called a friend of mine who had done a similar project but more for technology and medical life sciences, and he said, we're too busy, you know, we don't have time, and we already have a lot of property over here. Why don't you do it? And I said, yeah, why
really?
Not? Why don't I do it? And I started on this project. It was 5 years ago. It took a long time. It's a huge project. It wasn't that the building cost so much. It was the renovation of the building that cost so much. So this particular
right.
phase is about $80 million. And it is totally, you know, turning the hospital into apartments and the doctor's offices into offices for nonprofits. And then the second phase, which was the nursing school, which is a huge nursing school, is actually built for a school. And I've been thinking about how do we turn it into a school if anybody could afford to pay us the rent at that point. But we haven't decided on phase two, but this particular first phase is going to have apartments, and on the bottom level of the apartments will be a bank, a pharmacy. We'll have a restaurant, and we'll have a financial services company. And that's another challenge in these agents, in these neighborhoods. Nobody's ever invested to help people invest in their future. So even if you have a job and a good job and you make a six-figure salary, or your family makes a six-figure combined income, there's nobody there that's going to – there's no Edward Jones office or TD America or any of those that to help you invest, or Fidelity. So what do? You know, you could go find it, but it's not right in your backyard like it was in my backyard. I remember when I took my 401k and took it over to Fidelity because it was in a mall near my – in a strip center near my house. And I just walked in, and I happened to get my financial advisor that I had for a long, long time till he retired. I didn't even know him. You know, I just walked in. It was like the idea of retail, again, retail.
Right.
And the financial services business, which Fidelity basically invented, and Edward Jones here in St. Louis. So I say that there's all these opportunities. We just have to think about it in a retail, and I'm just going to change that a little bit, consumer-friendly way. That's what retail, that's what the mall was. It was consumer friendly. You could park your car, go inside, it could pour, it could snow, you were fine.
True.
You could shop to your heart's content.
Right.
There were many stores you could go in and out. They used to have a concierge. You could check your packages if you brought too many. God forbid you should buy too many packages. They had a concierge that you could check them so that you didn't have to carry them around, or you could go out to your car. Our mall here had a valet. You could have valet parking. I mean, it was amazing. And then they stopped it. They cut out all those nice things that you had at this mall because they were costing them money, and they decided to cut their expenses, and they ended up, you know, cutting out a lot of the services that I went there for. So it just is, it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. There are ways to save money that don't cost more money. And I'm going to give a good example. At Build-A-Bear, when we were starting Build-A-Bear, and I was looking at the creation of our box, the Cub condo that the bear goes home in, I had a friend who said to me, why don't you just use a bag? You don't need a fancy box. That's too expensive. If the business is successful, you can add the box later. And I went and priced it, and the box was cheaper than the bag. So sometimes we don't even know. We think something that looks like it's more money, and it doesn't cost more to paint a building yellow or white. If pink costs the same, there's no extra charge for color. And so people don't think about that. They think about just, just the simplest, easiest way. If I want to resell it, I better paint it all white. Well, nobody wants to walk into a white store. Remember, retail stores used to paint the ceiling black so you wouldn't notice it, and the store would look, dark. Well, you don't even look up. But if you look up, you start to see merchandise. You start to see, different things. We put a lot of stuff into our store that was not what everybody else was doing, and it was successful. And still people don't do it. You know, I'm sort of surprised. I mean, there haven't been that many other businesses where people engage you in the process while you're there in the store. Very few. And they haven't been very successful. And I think it's still an opportunity. I still think it's an opportunity.
I agree that, the repeat business that comes back in all industries is, and just like not in sales, for example, not retail, well, retail sales too, but it really is that atmosphere, that experience that people had. You know, if they feel good, they felt the integrity, they knew you cared about them. I think that's universal. And it seems I've seen as a consumer nowadays, it's backwards in many situations. They'll say no, that we, it's, and I agree, it's so easily fixed, isn't it? But
we had too many malls. We had too many stores. We don't need thousands. We never had 1,000 Build-A-Bear stores, but you don't need 1,000 of anything, really. And of course, with the internet, you absolutely don't need it. And you can also ship it from that store. The customer can pick. You can order it online and pick it up in store. There's so many options now that technology makes possible that you can just walk up, call them, and they'll bring it out to you. So the idea is to come into the store and buy more, but they'll still do that. They may not do it on Monday because they're in a hurry and they need that thing right away, or they need a birthday gift and they have to run by and get it. But they'll come back because the service that they want is at your store. You're giving
You've
them
done
exactly
such a
what they want.
Good job
want.
Of that. Of growing. There's so many people grew up with your memories and the loyalty, and you do care. And they had the repair service, right? You can do things, and they're involved. You're involved. Or the birthday month, I think, is different.
On your birthday, you pay your price.
Yeah.
Pay your age on for the bear. It's so many fun things that we've done through the years that have continued to adjust and change as the customer changes and as the times change. We've all had to learn from COVID.
Oh, COVID's been, I think, an eye-opener for many.
It made
people,
us do a
really?
Lot of things faster than we would have done them before. People were working on them, but it would have normally taken 3 years, and it took 3 months at the most, 3 weeks maybe.
Pivoting was amazing, isn't
people
it?
People were able
to
put it in place because they had to. It was survive or not, you know. And when you mm-hmm. when you're forced to do it, you do it. And I think we push too many things down, too many cans down the road. We're doing it now, you know, like we're going to talk ourselves out of infrastructure. We're going to talk ourselves out of these things. And then, you know, nobody's talking China out of it. They just do it. And so we're going to find ourselves without the proper educational basics for our children. In China, children learn to read. They don't read Chinese at 3, and they read English at 7. And we don't even, at the end of third grade, only less than 50% of all children in America read proficiently at the end of third grade. And that you're supposed to be able to read to learn then, and then you learn to read up to third grade, and after third grade, you read to learn. So if you're behind when you get to the fourth grade, you're in trouble. And it's known fact that private prisons plan around the reading levels of third graders. And I think that's just
crazy.
Really?
You know,
if you can't read, you're likely to get into trouble. Yes. Yes, it's one of the tools that they use, one of the demographics that they use to measure the need for prisons in the future. This is America. This is in America. Every country does that.
We are
in America. We have a lot of guns
right now. Yeah, we do.
And our infrastructure is old, and we have loosened our gun laws, and we put it in the hands of people who are desperate, don't have a future, don't think they have a future, and when they get into trouble. And schools should be a place that children can go to be, have hope, to see their dreams come true, to learn something new, to be inspired, to do art, to do sports, to do dance, to do music, and also learn to read.
I totally agree. I absolutely. I know I started reading to my son when he was 2 months old, and I remember my ex-father-in-law and ex-husband said, "What are you doing?" And I just ignored them, you know, and he's a readaholic, and I'm a readaholic. And it just, I do believe that we really, the families, the parents have so much to be involved in, you know, and I think if we could get in entrepreneurs or much more understanding of that, but I think it does start at home too, because we're in a time where, you know, there's so much pain and so much destruction, and getting into the hands, like you said, of the wrong people or people that didn't have any training or education when they're little. I mean, just children, just your basic, you know, love and manners and just things children, you know, that would get into. And you would think in a family unit, many aren't getting that at all. They're having, you know, parents that are not, you know, don't understand. So I just think if there's a way we can get into that besides our public school system.
I think parents are doing most parents do the best they can. I've never met a parent that didn't care. I'm sure there's some that just are parents by accident and don't really want to be a parent. But for the most part, all the parents that I meet that are not necessarily in prosperous families want to be good parents, but they have to work 3 jobs. They have to do all these things. They depend on other family members to be supportive. And they hope that their school is doing their job, that the school is teaching the children. And my mother never went to school. I don't remember whether my parents read to me or not. I don't know, but I love reading. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't. I don't know. Most people I ask, do you remember if your mother read to you? No, they have no memory. But we all learned to read because in school, that was the basics.
That's
you started in first grade and they taught you to read. So I don't blame it on the parent. I think parents have to be involved,
I'm not,
of course, but some parents
but
are,
I think they should
are
be
penalized
involved.
A little bit. Oh, absolutely.
I think they should be involved because I do agree with that. I agree with it, but they should be involved because there's a lot of situations where there's abuse and the parents are trying to survive and they're not really, you know. So I don't think they're doing it on purpose. I think they may not realize the tool. Like if they knew the tools that could help in a, you know, because of pressure that I've seen a lot of it, you know.
I think it's true. Most people don't have access to all the information. Or all the accessible things that might be free or discounted that, as you think they do, because they just don't. Or if they have a phone, it only works when they're in Wi-Fi, and they don't have Wi-Fi at their home. So there are lots of things that contribute to this ongoing poverty challenge that we have in America that we could easily wipe out. It could be done. If it's where there's a will, there's a way. And it's not even charity, because in 20 years, somebody's going to look back and say, they didn't have Wi-Fi in 2020? What do you mean? How's that possible? You know,
that's
like you might say that about indoor toilets, you know, 50 years ago. I mean, to me, these are all things that unfortunately financial if you have, there's the haves and the have-nots, and there always will be. But how do we make there less have-nots and more haves? And it doesn't mean they have to have the same amount, but they have to have the basis. And I think that's possible with better education, with social services that are, we don't need 16,000 nonprofits in St. Louis like we have. We need fewer, stronger ones. And that's a whole other challenge. Each community has their own things like that to deal with. And everybody says, oh, they can call 211 if they need help. Have you ever called 211? Most of us have never had to call 211. We don't even know what that sounds like on the other end.
I didn't know
when
about
you're desperate.
211. I mean, yeah, right,
yeah.
Exactly.
You know, when you're desperate, what does it feel like when you're desperate? You know, if you have to call 911, what does it feel like calling the emergency, you know, calling police? What does it feel like? You know, when somebody's calling an ambulance, when somebody's sick in your house. I mean, it's scary. Your adrenaline is on fever pitch, and it can be like that when you're in poverty also. So I think we just have to have more empathy for each other and realize that there's lots of things that contribute to difficult times in a family, even affluent families. And people need some, you know, a little bit of cut them a break and say, okay, how can I help
totally
you?
Agree.
And maybe you can do something really simple that would make all the difference in the world. And that's what I try to do. I think it's all about trying to, share what I know with others so maybe they can have a little bit more than what they have now. Not because I gave it to them, but because I opened a door that helped them get what they needed to do. People aren't trying to get a handout. They're trying to get a hand up. And I think that's a different way of looking at it.
I definitely agree that trying to get a hand up. I do. I just think there's a lot of there's a lot of different emotional issues too. There's so many issues, and it can be in overall different scales. You know, it's just kind of gosh, we are right down to the end. It goes by so fast. Didn't that hour go by fast?
It does.
It goes by.
It's always
about 3 minutes.
Get it.
I love you. You're amazing. You're just amazing, and I'm so just so thrilled to be able to talk to you. We've got about 3 minutes, but BluePoint4.com, is that an app that you? That is still
Blueprint
people can go.
Blueprint 4.
Okay.
It's in St. Louis, and it allows parents to find all the summer camp options that are available. And then camps, you can sort it by scholarships, by location, by type of camp, a million ways. And then there's Blueprint for college kids to find all the or high school kids that want to go to college programs in the summertime. There's also career, Blueprint for Career. And now coming out in the fall, we're having Blueprint for STEM, which is about all the after-school programs that are available for kids, STEM. And we promote this in the communities that otherwise would. It's available to everybody, but we make sure that people in the most needy communities know about it and so they can use it and have access to all the fun things that you and I would know about because our neighbor told us.
Right.
Our friend told us. You know, sometimes you just don't know. And technology can bring that to people. And the libraries post it and we post it, but it's only in St. Louis.
To put it right in all 50 states, huh? Get it out there.
Eventually.
That's beautiful. Yeah. Eventually, I know. You're so great at getting it done. And I think that's a huge talent to have, to actually see it, visualize it, and do it. And
yes.
I am so thrilled to have you on, and I want to be in touch and see how we can help, too. I'll check into that afterwards.
Okay, I look forward to it.
This is exciting, really exciting.
Yeah, thank you for your interest. It's been fun to talk to you, too.
Oh, you're amazing. You're just amazing. I'm really honored. And it's learned a lot today, too. And there's just always so much we can do and get involved and served and give
and
back.
It's fun.
And it comes
it
back.
Is fun.
Isn't it?
It does.
Absolutely. So we're going to – is there any last parting words you just want to say? Because we're going to – unfortunately, when we record it, 1 hour it goes off, which I don't like that, but that's part of how it works.
No, I don't have anything else to add. I think you've asked a lot of good questions, and I think they're – you know, our real estate connection is strong even in all this other work that you do in a community because it's all about location, location, location. So thank you for asking those questions, and thank you for being interested enough to see the value and not just being a retail entrepreneur but in being a social entrepreneur as well. I appreciate that.
Thank you so much. Look forward to that again. And to everybody out there, I wish you peace.